Welcome to the Continued Silence with me, Emma Jane Taylor, on UK Health Radio. The Continued Silence is focused on the very uncomfortable conversation of child sexual abuse and the importance of talking openly about this subject. We want to try and normalise the conversation. Child sexual abuse is real. It affects millions of people, young and old, across the world. The work we are doing is very much engaging more lateral thought processes on this terrible crime, supporting survivors, protecting children, and helping those not wanting to listen to listen. Joining me on my show is my resident panel therapist, Denny Corby, and activist, Chris Tuck. And also today we have the great pleasure of chatting to Dr. Sophie King-Hill. Sophie will tell you a little bit more about herself. And we are going to be talking today about the age of consent. And this is a very varied conversation, which I think is probably going to be quite lively today. So thank you for all of you for joining me again. Sophie, thank you for coming on today. So you're an associate professor, we know that. You're doing great work. Let's hear a little bit more about what you're doing, Sophie.
So primarily the work that I research and take part in is centred around the sexual behaviours of children and young people, so up to the age of 18. However, I have got a wider scope of work, which is looking at masculinity, misogyny, incels, so really extreme hatred of women. And I've got a project in Sierra Leone on period poverty. That's with some counterparts at the University of Illinois. But in terms of consent and talking around this aspect, a lot of my work has centred around relationship, sex and health education, and how we can support children and young people to negotiate consent within the remit of the law, but also with what is healthy for them developmentally. So that's the kind of the lens that I'll be bringing to today's discussion.
Thank you, Sophie. Denny, great to have you with us today. Again, a conversation, I think, like I said at the beginning, will be quite lively. This is such a big conversation today. Great to have you with us. Let's hear a little bit from you.
Yeah, hi, it's good to be back. It's nice to see everyone. Yeah, it's really complex, isn't it? And multi-layered. And for me, Sophie touched on that. It's the remit of the law, but then it's the reality of the behaviours of young people. And it's kind of balancing that up and looking at risk and protection and the reality of what young people are telling us. And I know, Sophie, you shout very loudly about this, but these decisions are often made by adults, and quite rightly so. There's boundaries, but we don't really get the voices of young people and the reality of what's going on in their lives. And I know that I sit in front of many young people and listen to their behaviours, their understanding, where they're being informed, where their sex, healthy relationship education is coming from. And, you know, I'm 55, I'm knocking on a bit, and it's very different to when I was a young person, and we have to hear those voices. So as always, I'm always interested to listen to you, Sophie, because you are the font of young people's voices.
The font of young people's voices. That's a great description for Sophie. Thank you, Denny. Chris, welcome to today's show, Age of Consent. As an activist, I'm sure this lively conversation will be very diverse today because of this conversation. Nice to have you with us. Let's hear from you.
Hi, everyone. Nice to be here. Yeah. All I can bring to today's conversation is obviously I was a young person once, and also I have two grown up children who I've had to navigate through this scary time of age of consent when they've come into being in relationships and how to protect themselves. One's a boy, one's a girl, so there are different ways of looking at this from their perspectives, and I would like to bring that into today's conversation if at all possible.
Yeah, anything's possible, Chris. Great to have you with us. Okay, so let's kick this off. Sophie, when I look at consent and children and the work that I've done, I've worked with children now for nearly 30 years in the performing arts industries. I've got to know children through their development from 3 until 18, when they're seen in the UK as adults. And what I regularly see is how they are developing. their minds are developing. The creativity part of the work that I'm doing is all very centered around age-appropriate work to help them develop safely within the performing arts arena. Obviously, it's a completely different sort of world that I live in when I have talking about this now. But what I've understood is that sort of between 3 and 4 years old to around 7, 8 years old, that's a very creative part of their development, and their minds are expanding. And then you move from sort of like 8 to 11, 12. They are starting to understand, but they're still very undeveloped with their brains. And so, whilst they are going through a learning process, they aren't able to fully understand and appreciate consent, what they need to do, and what they don't need to do, and how they can trust an appropriate behavior, and so on and so forth. So, some of the work that I'm doing is helping young people with, through my own work, through my charity, simply understanding those words, appropriate behavior, trust, and how to have good communication with people, and recognize if someone else might be behaving in ways that they aren't used to. What could that mean? Could they go and get them some help just by identifying? And then you move into sort of like the latter part of the young lives, 14 to 16, where they're getting much more aware physically, emotionally, hormones are kicking in, but still underdeveloped. And then you take that into what, many experts are saying, actually brains aren't developed until late teens, early 20s, some say le early 30s. This conversation of consent and sexual relations becomes a real problem for me as a survivor myself, and someone who works in this space at 9. Certainly at 12, I wasn't able to consent, and I was groomed. But when you look at the development of the brains, I was still underdeveloped and in a very creative part of my world, and absorbing the creativity and language around me. So I had no great skills and knowledge to be able to protect myself, which is obviously some of the work that I'm doing now. And then you go to consent. Now, some of the countries we've looked at on the ageofconsent.net forward slash world doc world document are that they are starting at 11 years old. Now, if you go back to what I was saying, that's just, for me, that is green lighting abuse. And I see that as child rape. I don't see 11-year-old consenting to a relationship as an acceptable behavior for anywhere in the world. So that's my opening starter for 10. Sophie, over to you.
Okay, so I think there's a few aspects that I can pull out of the things that you said there. So when we're talking about consent in children and young people, and then understanding the perceptions of consent, we can instill that from a really, really young age, just by asking their permission for things all the time, not saying, oh, go and give your nan a kiss, go and give your uncle a kiss, go and, is it okay if I don't know, get you changed, all those little kind of those small comments, and that environment that you can foster can really contribute quite heavily towards their perception of themselves, and that they have got autonomy and agency to make decisions. Secondly, I wanted to say, alongside that, we need those safe spaces where actually, if something did make them feel uncomfortable, that they would be able to talk about that in a safe environment and go and have somebody to talk to. But they need those two things running parallel. They need to recognize when actually they may not have consented to something, and then have somewhere to go to talk about it. So they're the two kind of aspects that I was thinking about when you were talking then. In terms of the age of consent, so in the UK, it was changed in 1885 from 13 to 16, and that was because of the campaigning by the NSPCC. They weren't called that then, but that was because due to their campaign. And for men, it was lowered, wasn't it, in 2000 to 16 here in the UK. However, the age of consent, we have to be careful whether, these discussions about raising the age of consent, because there are still very specific protections in law in this country for under 18s in terms of it's illegal to take photographs or videos, to pay them for sexual acts. If you're in a position of trust, so for instance, a teacher, you can't be in a sexual relationship with anyone under the age of 18. And obviously, with family, that's illegal as well. So there are protections for the under 18s in terms of child sexual abuse and exploitation and grooming. If we were to raise it from 16, then we might be taking away the agency of children and young people and they're developing sexual behaviors that are healthy. So again, you know, it is a really tricky conversation, you know, so there's lots of different elements to this. But I think when we listen to young people, you know, and when we know, I mean, we were young once as well. It was at 16, sexuality just doesn't drop out the sky. And then all of a sudden you think, oh, you know, I've got sexual feelings and urges. They're developmentally, they're incremental over a number of years. So I think that there's a few elements to consider there. Like I said, we need to be instilling consent from a young age in the tiniest little conversations we have with them. Then we need the safe spaces. We need to recognise we have got protections for under 18s. And we've also got to be careful of the agency of young people and criminalising healthy sexual behaviour between two young people. So yeah, you're right, it's really complex.
It's a big conversation actually with the charity that I'm working with. One of the things that we're looking at is permission. We have created PAC programs, permission, awareness, communication, and knowledge. And part of that is, you know, talking exactly like you say, gaining permission, understanding what's right and wrong. And you talk about sexuality, you know, when you get sort of 15, 16, you know, that hits you. But if you've already had that taken from you as a child, which children will have around the world, it becomes a very moot conversation, right? Because you're not going to flourish physically and sexually because you don't understand that because of the grooming process that that has happened as a child, you know, and certainly from where I sit, I mean, you know, I was nine. I know children who were a lot younger, some actually babies, right? And that's all they've ever known for a big chunk of their life, so they won't have a development in the sexuality world. So I think all of these conversations are really important, and I say that for the longer term good of this conversation, because right now we can create awareness, create campaigns, do anything that we can around this conversation to protect children, and instill now that, but it'll be a while before that becomes a regular part of everyday life. However, not only are we going to protect victims, but we're also going to protect potential risks from giving information to perpetrators, right? Because the education they're going to get from all of what you're saying, I'm saying, Chris and Denny, is that will give them a thought process that they might not have had at home or in their early life. So it works together for the longer term good. Wow. Okay, Denny.
Yeah, I was just listening to Sophie there, and my head went into how history paves the way for what we now make decisions and legislation around. And it won't surprise anyone who listens to this show and knows who I am that it got me thinking around the age of consent and the history of the age of consent for homosexual human beings, of which have always been on this planet and, you know, haven't all of a sudden come out of the woodwork. And so I went down that thinking of how damaging I believe it has been to have a higher age of consent for homosexual young people who continue to feel demonized, flawed, wrong. And it all then became a little bit underworld, really, in terms of how people played out their sexuality. So I just wanted to kind of acknowledge that there's been very differing age of consent depending on what sexuality you identify within. The brain aspect of it's interesting, isn't it? We're born with the neurons that are in our brain, and they don't change in adulthood, but it is the synapses and the connections that change and strengthen and develop. And we know, we've spoken about this at great length, that if you are sexually abused as a child, that severs development and has huge lifelong impacts. We can survive and we can manage and we can move through life, but it has huge impacts. But the opposite for me is also necessary to look at, and that is that all brains are different, right? And brains develop at different times depending on our experiential sense of the world. If we're in safe, stable, loving families where we kind of have this serve and return, where our serve is I have a need and the return is I can meet your need, then our brains will be developing beautifully as we would hope them to. But even so, they'll go at different speeds and at different levels. So I think that that's really important to acknowledge, because that's the difficulty, isn't it, of setting one age and one size fits all. And it's my statement of my time on this radio show of, you know, brains do develop differently. And I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't have an age of consent. Of course I'm not. But we have to be aware that experimental behavior and sexual and curiosity is happening anyway. So Sophie touched on it. For me, it's about what can we do for our young people that enables them to be perfectly normalized in having permission, saying no, pushing back on something that they don't feel is something that they would wish to be happening to their space, to their body. When I was working in the youth justice system, we kind of looked at how can we get young people to almost be their own risk assessors. And me and you and everyone else who works in this line know that many people get to their adulthood and it's only then that they realise that some abuse has taken place. So if we can give really good informed education, then hopefully our young people can risk assess their own behaviours. I think when young people feel shamed and when young people feel that they aren't being listened to, that's when actually, bizarrely, consent is often lost.
Yeah, and the permission thing I think is really important. And I can think about my own story when I sort of listen to you speak, Denny and Sophie. That sort of permission, I think, unfortunately, my story with the other loss of with my father around that time completely muddied the water. So I didn't have any sense or sensibility between me to work out. I just wanted someone to help me feel safer and more stable. And that was a very easy chew in for the person who groomed me. And that's what's happening, isn't it? So children, vulnerable children, are often being groomed by people that they know for whatever reason. And so this conversation is so multi-layered in many respects that it becomes quite difficult to sort of pull it apart. But by having this conversation today, we are doing just that, getting people to understand it's not so simple as just saying no to someone. It's deep-rooted, it's very technical in many ways, scientifically, when you think of how the bodies, the brains, and everything is developing. Chris, let's bring you up in onto the show.
So for me, what you've said is very valid when it comes to children and young people amongst themselves and the age of consent. But for me, the age of consent is there to protect children and young people from adults when it comes to sexual acts. And being mindful of when a child enters puberty, in some cultures, they can be married off. And for me, their bodies are not ready for sexual acts of any kind. They often get damaged beyond repair if sexual acts are done at an early age. It's almost like not only do we have to grow and mature mentally, we have to grow and mature physically as well. I had an internal examination when I was 9 by the police. Wasn't pleasant. Body not ready. So I can only imagine what some children and young people go through when they are being sexually abused at a younger age or married off legally in their country at a younger age. So I just wanted to bring that into this conversation as well.
Thanks, Chris. Look, we're going to take a quick break now. Don't go anywhere. We will be back after this.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, so we're talking about consent and the difficulties around this conversation. And Chris, before the break, was talking about, you know, it's the physical aspect, not just the mental aspect, but it's everything trapped in the pot, isn't it? That violation, if you're not ready for it, can take years to really sort of understand. And when I look at sort of stories, my own story, your story, other stories, you know, it's really not until your late 20s that the severity of what has happened in your childhood comes to the forefront of your thoughts, does whatever the abuse is, right? Whatever has happened to you as a child, because that's when you're starting to stabilize with your thoughts. Maybe the hormones are settling down as well, your body is changing. And I'm speaking as a woman here. So, you know, it's very, very difficult, isn't it, to really fully understand it. But I kind of keep going back to what I believe is that children are not prepared or ready to be able to consent physically or other as a child. And that's why it's really important to have this conversation. Like Sophie said, it's about preparing them to understand what they can give permission for. And that could come in simple, can you give me a hug? Actually, no, I don't feel comfortable because of ABC or whatever it is. And so that kind of the layering on the permission from an early age is really important. And that's certainly something that I'm very, very fixed on with the work that I'm doing. That permission, Sophie, that permission, the importance of it, and the lack of education around it that's happening now. You know, PSHE, unfortunately, I believe, is a tick box exercise throughout the academic year. And it shouldn't be, because we're living in the 21st century. This is the reality of a lot of the conversations now. And before you come in there, Sophie, I just want to also touch on what Chris has said. You know, I look at some 15, 16-year-olds, and they look like they are 25, 30 years old, right? Now, you look at some 15, 16-year-olds, and they're just looking like they're just going into their years as they should of that age. And of course, we've got the huge influences around those conversations because of social media. Now we should be able to be wearing what we want, but this rush to be grown up. Now, I do remember that myself. I vividly remember being sat in the park with my friend Sarah, and we were, God, I don't know how old we were, but she said, let's throw an extra couple of years on our ages. When the other kids came over, we were like, oh yeah, we're 4 or 5 years older than we were. But why? Why do we do that, Sophie?
I think there's a very specific need in adolescence, isn't there, for them to be seen within the domain of adulthood, whereas the older generations seem to see that age category within the domain of childhood, when in reality it's a transitionary period between one and the other. So it's them trying to kind of claim their adulthood, whereas within wider society they're being viewed as children. I think as well, coming back to your point about relationships, health and sex education, you know, it is vitally important that they get that incrementally from a young age. And all the research tells us that they're more likely to delay sex and sexual activity if they've got all the information they need. Because as well, I suppose another element to this, they need to know what they're consenting to. They don't want to have to be thinking about consent at 11 o'clock at night at a party, on the coats, on a bed. They want to have had that conversation and that thought process beforehand in a safe space to think, actually, if I was in that position, I don't want to do that, rather than kind of thinking in the moment. So it's all that kind of that legwork that needs to come before, to allow that position of informed consent. And those that are do look substantially younger, or may not as be as mature as the other ones, probably won't choose to consent. But we need to be having that conversation a lot further back. I worked with 20 years ago, I worked with teenage parents. It was one of the most inspirational jobs I think I ever had. You know, it's 20 years ago, I still miss it. They were wonderful young women. They were aged 14 and 15. And a key turning point in my career was, and some of you might have heard this story before, is I went to teach them. I'd known them quite well over a period of 3 months. And one of them said, before we start, can you just tell me how I got pregnant? And then the next one said it, and the next one said it. They were wonderful mothers, but they had no choice. They knew it was sex. They had no idea about ovulation, about contraception, you know, because they hadn't had those spaces to make those decisions beforehand. And those decisions were taken away. Like I said, the caveat is they're amazing mothers. They had a bit more energy than me, but they love their kids as much as I love mine. So it's, you know, hats off to them. But that was a real turning point in my career that I thought, actually, this is where education is crucial, you know, at a young age to allow those choices. So And then coming on to your other point in terms of, I think it's, this was Chris's point, you know, it's all well and good talking about relationships between young people, but what about if it's an older person? And I recently wrote an article in The Conversation about Russell Brand, and he was in a relationship with a 16-year-old, and there was a big discussion about raising the age of consent, which I would be against because of the reasons I set out. I don't think it would change anything substantially. What we need to do is change the conversation. So by having conversations like this on why toxic power imbalance relationships are largely ignored within society. So as soon as someone's hit 16, you've got someone in a position of power like Russell Brand going out with them, you know, having a relationship with them. We should be questioning that as a society because of the power imbalance and because of the toxicity around it.
Yeah, and again, that goes back to what I was saying about if we are educating children to be, you know, help them understand permission, awareness, and everything else that we're talking about here. Not only do we protect children from becoming victims, we help potential perpetrators understand their responsibility and the huge impact on this conversation. Okay, Denny, 24 minutes into this show. It feels intense, immense, and I feel that the show length here won't give us really enough time on this, but some points from you already, your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I've got Maslow's hierarchy of need in my head, because we're talking about consent as a overall umbrella. Consent is hugely important for protection. It's hugely important in legislation. It's hugely important for young people to know how to consent, what is consent. But we also have it in different spaces, playing out in differently, because I'm sat here and I was thinking, we've spoken so far about the ability to give consent, to verbalise consent. We know, don't we, that child sexual abuse, very sadly, is very high statistics with our most vulnerable young people, which are nonverbal and with learning disability. And so we've got another space that we then have to have slightly different considerations for. So I think that's why, I'm not sure whether Sophie will agree, but this is so complex, because we're human beings, we're messy, and we are different, and we have differences. Mm-hmm. And so consent is really difficult to just put a fence around for a group of people. We have to consider other spaces and other aspects of ability to give consent. So that was what was in my head at that moment.
And actually, I just want to go back to what Sophie was saying about, you know, giving consent at 11 o'clock at night. Now, of course, a lot of kids are out drinking. That will take away any kind of thought around consent. So how do we navigate those conversations? Because at 11 o'clock at night, when party's going and you've had a few drinks, you know, it's very difficult. And that's where not only is it going to be difficult for you to consent, or a child to consent, or 15-year-old, but also the person having the relationship with that person at that time should know what's right and what's wrong. There are, you know, and it becomes very difficult, doesn't it, Sophie?
Yeah, it does. You know, it's kind of, and that's a rational response in that situation. So this isn't kind of condemning people that find themselves in that situation. But if the legwork's been done beforehand, they'll actually know what they do and don't want to do, because they've had the space to think about it and consider it. I can give another example from when I've worked with young people. So this was some years ago. And I had a couple of 15-year-old young women come up to me and say, you know, we're going to have anal sex with our partners because you don't get pregnant. So, you know, when you've got that calm exterior, but the inside's running.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I regularly.
And educated them all around all aspects of anal sex. And I mean, consent and safety, not condemning it. And then once they'd got all the information they needed that they hadn't had before, they were like, actually, yeah, I probably don't want to do that. But that was because then all of a sudden they had the information and they made an informed decision. If they had all that information, thought, actually, I want to go ahead with this. This is a mutually consensual act. But in that instance, they were like, oh, actually, yeah, we don't want to do that. So that was an example of them not doing something in the moment. It's us saying, look, here's all the info, now make your decision. You know, so it's, we're not telling them what to do, it's giving them the information. And I think that that process has to take part, take place beforehand, but has to build incrementally as well. So we can't just suddenly start talking to 14-year-olds about things like that out of the blue, because they'll just fall around laughing and they won't listen. And because of the shame that surrounds it, again, that's a rational response. But if we're building these conversations from a really young age around consent, around permission, and start kind of bringing in sexual behaviours, that's when they'll get to the party and go, actually, no, this isn't, I've thought this out, I don't want to do this.
It's interesting. Can I just butt in there? Cause
yeah, go.
Taking me back to when, you know, I was placed in two or three schools to pilot a scheme around sexual education, relationships, and the barrier that I faced was that the more information we gave, the more kickback we got from parents. Parents were terrified. Parents were ringing up the school and saying, I don't want my child to be taught about gay sex, sex, in, you know, in any context. So I guess I think part of this conversation for me is we also have to deal with the wider context of society in this, and how do we get parents to, I guess, lose their shame, their fear, their experiences of their own sexual upbringing. And because for me, working in schools, and I know, Chris and EJ, you do too, that has been my biggest barrier, is that we can all work with young people. We're all pretty skilled in that, in terms of rationalizing all of those giggles and shame that goes along with it. But my greatest barrier, and still to this day, is for me, the adults in this conversation who really struggle and have this kind of, I think, misplaced fear. There's a misplaced fear out there from parents around what their children are being taught. And I often say, whilst I can understand that, we all come to the table with our own experiences and our own fears and our own anxieties. Trust me, your children are getting far worse from their iPads, their phones. So how do we deal with that aspect of it?
Sorry, I know Chris is going to jump in, but before Chris jumps in, I worked with a young girl last year, 2 years ago now, actually, and she said to me, she'd been abused and gone through severe difficulties, and I said, you know, as a young sort of 15-year-old now, what do you think you could share? Because she wants to be an advocate for young people. She said that I wished my parents hadn't given me a phone when I was 7 years old. Chris.
Yeah, I just wanted to sort of like bring maybe a few points together. So I'm 54. I think you're all of similar ages. I wouldn't, you know, like to claim that, but
we
the
are.
Education for us at school was putting a condom on a banana. That's what we learned. At age 14, maybe, if I remember rightly. However, the sexual abuse that I'd had from age of nine onwards, I already knew more than obviously what they taught me at school. And the point is that we can only change the way the next generation responds to this by changing the education to them right now. Because if we are the adults of yesterday putting condoms and bananas and we can't have these conversations, it's not going to change until we do the education and do the awareness in a proper way, like you've all explained. So we need to make this change somewhere. And in order to better protect our younger people from sexual abuse and exploitation, this has to happen, no matter what the parents are doing about kicking back against it. I don't understand that kickback. Because of what I went through with my children, I made sure we had normal, open, transparent conversations about all of this, because it's important. And I don't get why some don't want to do that. I don't get it. Educate me.
Educate you, Chris. Let's educate you after this next break. Don't go anywhere. We will be back with Chris's comments after this.
The station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Okay, Sophie, so Chris wants to have another look at the what we're doing at home, education and children and so on. But before we touch on that, I have great concerns about some of the material that's already out there for children, and also some of the material some people share already in schools, on conversations around abuse. Over sexualizing children, whatever that conversation is. And it's about getting this right, isn't it? Because like Chris says, we need to have open conversations, but we need to do it right, the right way. And what does that look like?
I think what we've got to do is it's got to be context dependent. So if you've got 9-year-olds in a classroom and somebody's sharing pornography, you have to teach about pornography. You have to be led. There's going to be some kind of foundations that need to be taught, but then you've got to be willing to adapt and change in relation to the needs of the children and young people. We've also got to keep in mind that the internet is here. Sometimes, you know, with the previous government's draft guidance, I think they forgot there was an internet, you know, in terms of some of the age parameters they were putting on things. I was like, did they forget there's an internet? And young people are accessing things younger and younger. So I think we've got to have a realistic view on this. You know, we're not sexualizing children when we're teaching them about their bodies, about sexual behaviors. We're keeping them safe and we're giving them safe spaces to come and talk to trusted people about things they might be going through or things they might have seen, you know, on WhatsApp groups. And even if you don't give a child a phone, or they're not part of a group that's sharing pornography, someone will go up to them and go, look at this, and show them. And I've had conversations with parents. I'm a governor at a secondary school. And in terms of the parent conversation, we have to do it gently and with compassion and understanding that everybody wants to keep their children safe. But of course, they've grown up with the, you know, the sex and relationships education Chris was talking about, you know, that there wasn't much there. And so we've all got that shame that society has given us. And so it's very difficult for them to have that conversation. So if I think, I was talking to a parent once and she was quite tearful about, she didn't want a 13-year-old to talk about pornography, which for me, that I think that's a bit too late to teach it. But when I spoke to her, I said, look, I can pretty much guarantee your daughter will see pornography either unintentionally or intentionally by the time she's 18. Do you want her to know what's coming and have a safe space to explore what she's seen? Or do you want her to see it and not know what it is? And you could see the kind of cogs turning. And, you know, it's an educated woman. And I said, all the research tells us this is how we keep children and young people safe. This is what children and young people are telling us that they need. So it's that combination. But also, it's really difficult to engage with some parents. It's really hard to just get them through the door, you know, on anything, you know, because we all live busy lives. So it's a hard job for schools to negotiate anyway, because from my experience over the years, schools have always been really open to engaging with parents and making a really kind of a good relationships and sex ed curriculum that works at home, you know, and transitions into school. So there isn't conflicting things being taught. So I think, again, it's, we've got to respect where people come from. We've got to be transparent. I think blaming is no good, and nobody has said anything. Nobody said anything that's been blaming parents, but I think, yeah, I do hear that a lot. It's like, oh, the parents need to sort it out. It's their fault. You know, they need to educate themselves. Well, they're not in a position to do that when we've grown up with shame around sex, around developmentally appropriate sexual behaviours. There's shame. You know, anything that sits outside of that parameters is even worse, especially for the people going through it. So I think we've got to really consider that, you know, the parents are in a really difficult position. There's no education for parents. There's no support for parents. You know, when you have a baby in the UK, you get a little booklet and tells you, you know, that when they're probably going to start walking and babbling and things like that. There is nothing given to parents in terms of support on sexual appropriate and healthy sexual development and how they can support that and keep their children safe at the same time.
Which is why you're here, Sophie, because you do that in abundance and we're grateful to you for doing so. Sophie is an incredible, credible woman doing so much. You can find her if you go and Google Sophie, Dr. Sophie King Hill, you'll find everything about Sophie. I've worked with Sophie on a number of occasions over the years. She's someone who I feel completely inspired by. If you go to have a look at TED.com, you will also see her TED talk. And it says she will challenge you to look at how teenagers are understood, how sex is perceived, and the subsequent impact. She says, stop talking about the weather. And I think you're absolutely right there. We need to really, really look at the realities of this, you know. And I guess just before Denny does the roundup, it's teaching age appropriate conversation. So if you're going to talk about pornography to a child of whatever age, it say 10, you're not going to have that same conversation with a 12-year-old, a 14-year-old, a 16-year-old, and an 18-year-old. Is age appropriate and awareness more than knowledge. It's awareness of what it is, so it's not a shock, because like you say, it's eyes wide open round now, isn't it? What is sex? Well, what sex is to a child of primary age to a senior school and a young adult, an adult, is going to be a very different conversation. And so what you're doing, Sophie, is bringing age appropriate language to the forefront of this, and incredible to be doing so. So thank you, Sophie. Denny, over to you for the roundup on today's show. We are down to the last couple of minutes. It's been a great show, but I'm interested to hear what you have to say, Denny.
Yeah, as always, these topics are so wide, aren't they? But for me, I want to start with where you finished off with the kind of sex and different conversations for different age groups. And I think we all agree with that. But what we can also agree is that pornography doesn't accommodate. That's the big difference. So for me, when I'm gently talking to parents, as Sophie suggests, this isn't about blame. This is about giving parents the confidence that what we are saying, we are educating, will actually have a positive impact, is to actually beautifully highlight that your child's visual learning from pornography is not accommodating to their age. So we can do that. We can do it in a healthy way. I think Chris touched on a really important point when we were talking about age of consent, that there's the age of consent and complexity around peer group and teenagers on teenagers. And then there's a very different space, which is around adults and on children. So I think Chris was really right to pick that up. I really agreed with Sophie, and again, it's part of my work, whether I'm sitting here as a therapist or sitting with my work in schools, that surely if we can teach young people that they can have choice, autonomy, and agency in terms of their bodies and their space around them, then that's a brilliant starting point. And the younger we teach them that, the better. We haven't touched on this aspect, and I know we're running out of time, but I think it's really important that that leads on to what Sophie said about the safe spaces. We need to provide safe spaces for young people to talk without this fear of judgment, shaming, and adults panicking actually around them. But also, I feel very strongly that at the point of a disclosure of a sexual abuse, we also have to continue to keep campaigning to protect children when they come forward, because there's disparity in that. Sadly, I still see the courage of young people who come forwards who ultimately do not end up being protected. So I think it's a kind of funnel approach. It's age of consent is at the top here, and then there's all these layers underneath. But I think it's been a great conversation today.
I think so too. And I think it's really undone lots of conversations and hopefully opened up more conversations for the listeners to take forward in their own worlds, which is exactly why we're here, all of us. So if you want to speak to Dr. Sophie King Hill, if you go, she's on LinkedIn, Dr. Sophie King Hill. And like I say, she's everywhere on the internet. Do you have a website, Sophie? Or was it
My
through the
stuff
Birmingham?
page, everything's on my stuff page
Yeah,
from
on
the
the
University of
Birmingham.
Birmingham.
Yeah. Denny is Denny Corby dot, sorry, Denny Corby Counselling dot co, and Chris is at Chris Tuck underscore WWHF. Or you can find her with her charity at sob.org on Twitter. It's been a great show. It's great to see Denny back with us today. Great to see you again, Sophie. Always great to see you, Chris. Thank you to everybody involved in today's show and helping us put it together from front of house here with the presenters and the panel, and also to Johan at UK Health Radio and to Christine working behind the scenes. It's been great. Keep talking, and I'll see you next time.